Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Rolling Stone magazine started in 1967, and for the first 3 years, Baron Wolman was its chief photographer. Those were heady days, a seminal time in history and in the rock music business. Wolman was there for most of it, capturing the story on film. The Central Ohio native has written a new book about his work with Rolling Stone. It's called Every Picture Tells a Story, The Rolling Stone Years. He's here with us today to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You know, first of all, given the state of celebrity photography these days, I wondered if we could first talk about the distinction between what you were, which was a photojournalist, and, you know, shooting the stars, and what is now considered the paparazzi chasing the stars.
The difference is night and day. You got to remember, I was living in the Haight-Ashbury in, what, the mid-60s, mid to late 60s, and that's where all these musicians were living, too. They weren't stars or anything like that. They were neighbors. You'd see Janis Joplin on the street. You'd see the Grateful Dead on the street. Jefferson Airplane lived a couple of blocks away. So it was more like we were all friends and family, and you know, we weren't taking celebrity pictures. We were taking pictures of our friends, and they just happened to start playing music. The great thing was is that there were all these free concerts in the park all the time, in Golden Gate Park and in the Panhandle and stuff. And so there were our friends playing music. So, of course, we were taking pictures of our friends playing music. It made perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, if you want to know what it's like now, it's horrible. You know, I had all access. Access was the key. Access is the key to intimate photojournalistic style photographs. So I could be on the stage, I could be off the stage, I could be backstage, I could be anywhere I wanted to all the time. Never any question, me and my cameras. Now they stick the photographers in one spot in front of the stage. They give them two or three songs. Right. Everybody gets the same picture, you know. And if you're lucky, you get to go maybe backstage for a little bit of time. But the other thing is they make you sign away all your rights so you don't own anything. So why are you doing it if you have a passion except just to be close to the musicians? And that's not enough. One of the things, and it's very interesting, is that when Jan Wenner told me about the beginning of Rolling Stone and told me about his idea, this was before.
He's the publisher and the founder, right?
The publisher and the founder, yeah. He and Ralph Gleason. He said, this is what we're going to do. What do you think about it? It sounded like a good idea. You know, he didn't want to do another trade publication. He wanted to do a publication for exactly those of us who live in the neighborhood, for the listening to the music, love the musicians. And I said, well, it sounds like a good idea. And he said, well, you know, and he says, you want to be the photographer? I said, well, sure, I'll be the photographer. But, you know, you say yes to everything if you're smart in life. You can always say no down the line, but you better say yes first before, right. Otherwise you'll miss an opportunity. So I said, sure, I'll do that. He says, well, do you have $10,000 to invest in the publication, you know? And I said, ah, sorry, Jan, I don't have that, but I'll tell you, I'll make a deal with you. I'll work for free, you know, in exchange for stock in the company. And he said, sure, no problem. There was no company, so it was easy for him to say that. But, and this is the thing, I don't know how I had the prescience mm-hmm. and the presence of mind to say, one thing I got to tell you, I own all the pictures. He says, no problem, you can own all the pictures. Well, that has made all the difference.
It's a huge difference. I mean, anyone who shoots for any publication, now the publication owns it.
Exactly.
And you also, you took possession of the pictures, but Rolling Stone could use them anytime they wanted.
Of course, that was part of the deal, you know.
And the stock in the company, did that ever pan out for
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah.
He said with a smile on his face, folks. My guest is Baron Wolman. He's a photojournalist, and he's author of Every Picture Tells a Story, The Rolling Stone Years. It tells the story of his 3 years with the Rolling Stone magazine, the first 3 years of Rolling Stone magazine. If you have a question or comment for Baron, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Or you can go on to Facebook. We have our Facebook page, and you can do that there. And we're also online at wosu.org/allsides. So if you have a question or comment, we welcome them. Let's listen to a little music.
Why not?
It seems like the right kind of show. Janis Joplin, in your short bio on the website, it says you live just a few doors down from Janis Joplin, one of the most really emotive female artists and singers of her time, if of all time. Let's listen to that now. You know you got it if it makes you feel good. Yeah, you know, I just love these kind of programs where we can sit and listen to music like that. So you live just, you're a neighbor of hers. That's a good example?
It's a perfect example. I mean, like, as I said, I'd see her on the street. I went over to her house one day. This is really funny, to take some pictures. And a friend of mine, Bob Seideman, had photographed her kind of semi-nude, and they had done a poster, this really beautiful poster, not explicit or anything like that. And Jana said to me, you know, Baron, I'm the first hippie, what'd she say, pinup girl. But I went into her bedroom, and one wall entirely was covered with these posters. She must have had 50 of them put up on the wall of the same poster of herself, you know, to wake up in the morning and say, hello, Janice, hello, Janice, hello, Janice. But actually, the best story about Janice for me, and the one I remember so well, is that Rolling Stone could not publish color photos. We were a newsprint publication. Another magazine came along. Hearst decided they wanted to get in on the counterculture business, you know.
What, this Cream or?
Huh? What? No, no, no. This was called EYE. Okay. Big, fancy, the size of life, the way it used to be, you know, color pictures, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't steal us. They just borrowed us, some of the writers and the photographers. So they called up and they said, look, we need a color photo of Janice in concert. Well, I didn't have any, obviously, because I was shooting black and white. So I called Janice and I said, do you have anything coming up? Because I want to shoot you in color in the, you know, live action. She said, no, I don't. I'm sorry. I said, okay, well, I'll tell you what. Let's do this. I'll set the studio up, because I had a studio in my house. We had a three-bedroom house. I took out a wall, made two of the bedrooms the studio. I said, come over to the house, bring a microphone, and you can lip sync, and we'll make it as if this was a concert. She says, okay. So she came over with a microphone dressed like she would be for a concert. Mm-hmm. And she brought a little tape recorder so she'd have something to lip sync to. And I set it up. We started shooting. And she started lip syncing. And then about 30 seconds later, she started. And then a little bit like. And within 5 minutes, she was singing full tilt, just like she was on stage. And for an hour, she sang for me alone, gave me a concert in my studio as I was taking pictures. But, I mean, I was going crazy. I always call it the concert for one, right? And the pictures, when you see the pictures in the book, you would swear she was actually performing. Well, she was. Yeah, exactly.
How generous of her.
Very, 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 very. She was a good spirit, yeah.
Did it feel like it was that typical, or was that, it's a great story about her and it's probably somewhat unusual, but still that spirit, was that typical
at the time? Yeah, at the time, that's the way it was. And that's why I say, when you've got friends, you know, you're really calling on your friends. You're not calling on a star or anything. None of these people yet were quite the stars that they became, by a long shot, you know. They were emerging. Although, I will tell you this, in the period of time I was shooting, the changes that I saw kind of led me to a statement that I ended up believing pretty strongly, and that was that the business of the music became bigger than the music itself. And it was so sad because in that process, the innocence was lost. Now, you can say, well, you can't deny music from people who want to hear the music, you know, because the concerts went from small little 200, maybe 1,500 people to 10, 20, 30, 40,000 stadium concerts. And, you know, you couldn't stop it. It was just that was the way it was going to be. But I kind of mourned the loss of those innocent free concerts in the park. And anyhow, it was an interesting change.
Well, to hear you talk about it now, there's sort of an irony there because before Rolling Stone came along, all of the publications had to do with the business.
Pretty much, except for Cream and Crawdaddy, which were, you know, but they were not mainstream yet. Rolling Stone, Jan said from day one, he said, we're going to be successful, we're going to be mainstream, we're going to be national. You know, these other ones are fine, but...
And it would be about the musicians and about the music lovers, but by the time you left, your feeling was that the business had gotten bigger than even them at that point. And they went on to report, and it speaks for itself, the history of Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone itself. Well, I mean, I you know, people say, oh, what do you think of it now? I said, look, Rolling Stone is a very important publication, has been from day one in our society. If you really want to get a cross-section of what it was like to live in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, read Rolling Stone. I mean, the music is one thing, but the lifestyle and the politics, they were spot on, and that writing was great. The editing was great. You know, there's no apologies necessary. Of course, they stumble here and there, as we all do. But fundamentally, it's a really important contribution, I think, to the history of the social history of our country.
But you left after 3 years. Wasn't that kind of hard to do?
No, I'll tell you what. I have this theory, and, you know, other people have heard me say this before, but I see life as a big buffet table, kind of a smorgasbord. And, you know, if you get stuck at the appetizers, you're going to miss the soup and the salad and the entrees and the meat and the fish and the dessert. I mean, there's so much going on in life. I finally said, you know, I'm shooting the same pictures over and over again, just different faces. And so the challenge wasn't there. There were a lot of things that I brought to Rolling Stone that I'm very happy about. For example, in the beginning, not only did we do music, we had a poet laureate, Richard Brautigan, you know, the mm-hmm. guy that did
trout fishing in America. In America, right.
And then I said, Jan, near where I lived, they were I found out they were skating roller derby, the real roller derby, you know. So off I went, and I said, Jan, we got to do a story about roller derby. We did a story about roller derby. And then because I grew up in Columbus and football was in my DNA, I got involved with the Oakland Raiders, you know, and I said, I got a great story about the Raiders. And so they did a couple of stories about football, too. So nothing was off limits, which was so great about Rolling Stone in those days.
You also suggested the iconic, really, groupies issue.
Yeah, I did. I mean, first of all, I love photographing women. That's where mm-hmm. that's the bottom line. But more importantly, when I was backstage, I noticed there was something about the women that were backstage in those days that they weren't just women trying to get a guy. You know, they clearly spent a lot of time putting themselves together, clothes-wise, makeup-wise, very exotic, feathers, and, you know, these were like peacocks. I mean, usually mm-hmm. the guys are the peacocks, but these are these women. And I talked to them, they were really extraordinary young women, you know, and I told Jan, I said, you know, I think there's a story here. He said, yeah, let's do the story. Well, that story then evolved into an entire issue.
Right.
You know. I met some pretty interesting. Anyhow, sorry.
My guest is Baron Wolman. He's a photojournalist and he's author of a new book. It's called Every Picture Tells a Story: The Rolling Stone Years. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Join WOSU Public Media for a Chefs in the City coffee brunch at the elegant Deepwood Restaurant. The event is Saturday, July 23rd at 10:30 a.m., and tickets are on sale now for $45 each. A handcrafted seasonal brunch will be presented by Chefs Brian Pollock and Amber Heron of Deepwood. Guests will also learn to make excellent coffee at home with Andy Luck of Luck Brothers Coffee House. Tickets are limited. Visit wosu.org/chefs to reserve yours now.
You've got dinner table discussion, water cooler chat, even pillow talk, but how often are you part of the national conversation? I'm Neil Conan. Raise your voice on everything from the news of the day to the twists and turns of culture and history on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons at 2 on 89.7 NPR News.
Working for the man every night and day. And I never lost one minute of sleep and worrying about the way things might happen. Big wheel keep on turning, turning, round, never keep on burning, burning, rolling, rolling, rolling.
Now, that's, of course, Ike and Tina Turner singing Proud Mary, and that's in 1971. You photographed Ike and Tina Turner at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco. When you took pictures of them performing, you said you were less than 12 feet away and that the pictures show that close-up action. But despite that kind of access that you had back then, it was not, you didn't necessarily know what was going on in their lives. There wasn't a lot of personal kind of interaction.
No, not for me. I mean, there might have been. So I had a couple other photographer friends, Jim Marshall, who died last year, excellent photographer, and another friend of mine now who's still shooting called Michael Zagaris. Now, these two guys actually like to hang out with the bands. They, for whatever reason, wanted to be part of the scene. They figured they were bringing something to the party, you know. And I knew I was bringing something to the party, but I had a wife, and she was a ballet dancer, and I had to earn a living. And, you know, I mean, yeah, I would have liked to have partied with them more than I did. But I was really, Rolling Stone, it was a job for me. First of all, I mean, more importantly, it was a job with no pay. So, I mean, I had to work really hard to get no money. And so then I had to use the other time when I wasn't working for Rolling Stone to actually do things that you know, gave me money. Subsequently, I've become somewhat more friendly with them. But for me, it was in and out. I tried to get the most intimate photographs I could because I'd learn something about them before I'd go. And I'd talk to them and I'd get them start to talk about themselves so they'd relax and we'd get some great pictures. But, you know, I wasn't curious about the stuff that people are curious about now, you know.
Yeah, it just seems ironic because you talk about access and how little access journalists have to the big stars now. You see them on the red carpet and that kind of a thing, and they're very limited at concerts. But we know so much more about them. It's kind of a strange
irony. Do we care? Should
irony.
We care?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole different conversation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's the way we know about it. Yeah. In other words, we you know, or you know, journalism's traded that particular point of view that you had back in those three short years for something, more information, maybe too much information.
Well, it's interesting. Let me say this, is that when Rolling Stone started, there was very little information at all about these people.
Right.
I mean, nobody knew what they looked like if they bought a vinyl and saw a picture of them on the vinyl, but they never saw the real people. And what I thought I was giving them is a visual look into the real people so that they'd have some kind of a little better idea of who these people were.
Former Rolling Stone managing editor John Burks said that your work seemed accidental when he looks back on it. So what does he mean by accidental, do you think?
That's a good question. I don't know.
He said that the sort of work you do isn't possible anymore. But accidental, like maybe you just kind of showed up and...
Well, I don't know. Accidental to me has a pejorative connotation to it. It was never accidental because I would go, I mean, really, as I said before, I would never go into a situation without doing a little background study. There was no Google, but it took, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I could try to find out as much as I could about the people I was going to photograph. There was no accident, I don't believe. I don't like this.
Well, especially because you point out that it was much tougher back then to photograph something really as ephemeral as a rock concert because there were no automatic cameras.
Yeah, right. There's,
you had to kind of plan ahead. How did you do that?
You had to work hard. There's no autofocus, no auto exposure. The lights were changing all the time, you know. I had so much equipment you wouldn't believe, and it was heavy, and there was no motor drive. And one of the things, here's what I learned. This was one of the keys that I learned, two keys, but the most important one was if you're at a concert and you're paying attention and you see, listen, I didn't hear the concerts. I saw the concerts. I didn't have time to listen to the music. I had to watch a performer. So if I saw the performers do something that was very photogenic, And I missed it, of course, because it would be the first time. I realized it's probably a chorus that they're going to repeat. So I would get ready, and when I saw the little hint that here it comes again, I'd start shooting. And that was the way I was able to get some pictures that were really important because you have to be there in advance of the event happening. If you see the picture in the viewfinder, it's gone. You've lost the picture because it takes that long to, you know, to push the shutter, and they've changed since then. So it was hard work. I mean, these guys now have it so easy. They go out and they buy a $5,000 camera.
Rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat.
Exactly. Come on. How hard is that?
If you are a fan of the Rolling Stone, certainly a fan of the early Rolling Stone, the early years, the first 3 years, you'll be interested in Baron Wallman. He's my guest. He's a photojournalist and author of an upcoming book about that experience. It is called Every Picture Tells a Story, The Rolling Stone Years. He's in town, and if you want to talk to him now, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said that you didn't feel like you were taking a picture, but that you were like a conduit of the experience. But you said you really weren't listening to the music.
Yeah, well, like I said, you can't you cannot listen to the music. If you stop to listen to music, you'll miss the picture. You know, I had one show I called I Saw the Music, because I figured when I was working there, I was looking at the music rather than hearing the music. But the whole idea of that, of me being a conduit, we were talking about this last night. There was a photographer at dinner, and something happens when you get into what this kind of cliche phrase called in the zone. Mm-hmm. You're so connected to what is happening that it's almost, you don't stop to think. You lose all sense of self. You're just in the moment, you know, and it happens to be that part of the moment is pushing the shutter, but you're so, listen, the best picture I ever took of a live concert was the shot of Jimi Hendrix that's on the cover. But I felt truly, and I know this sounds a little pedantic and a little, maybe a little bit too much presumptuous to say this, but I felt that I was in the band. I was so connected to what was going on that he was playing his Fender, his Gibson, I don't know what, and I was playing my Nikon. I was so much in touch with what this moment was, and I don't even remember doing it. But when it was done, there were these pictures. Usually in the old days, you know, you'd have a roll of film, 35 shots or something like that. If you got two or three really great shots, hey, I nailed it. Mm-hmm. But I developed the film, came back, developed the film, did the contact sheets, and on each one of these, there were like 20 great shots. So I knew that something else was going on, you know. I mean, I was there with the camera, but I think there was some magical creative force that was flowing through me that allowed me to do
did
that.
Did you save every negative?
Well, yeah.
Just checking.
Which one do you throw away, you know?
Exactly. Just checking. 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you want to talk to Baron Wolman. He's in the studio right now. Let's listen to some more music. That's the good part of the show. Let's listen to the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones have gone down in rock and roll history, of course. They're still out there, you know, amazingly. And you were photographing them in their peak years, I guess, or their first peak years.
Sorry about that.
during the late 1960s when they came out with songs like Jumping Jack Flash. That, of course, is the Rolling Stones singing Jumping Jack Flash. That's in 1968. Do you remember the first time you photographed them for Rolling Stone?
Yeah, I remember that. But it just something occurs to me when I'm listening mm-hmm. to that song is that that song has a power right now, 40, 50 years later. And you wonder how much music that's being made now is going to have that kind of power 40 or 50 years later. There was something that really, and the Beatles were the same way, mm-hmm. that talked to something in our soul about what life was all about, and I'll get back to your original question, but you know, I photographed them the first time, and I think it was December. This is very important, November 1969, and that was after Woodstock. Woodstock had just happened in August of 1969. And they had been encouraged to come to the Bay Area. Everybody was saying, oh, you're making so much money. You need to give us a free concert. Give us a free concert. They finally relented, and they gave a free concert. Well, in November 69, they came as part of the tour. Then they said, okay, in December, we're going to give you a free concert. And so I remember the day they announced it. It was in New York, big press conference. They came, and originally it was supposed to take place in Golden Gate Park, perfect venue. Lots of great free concerts had happened in Golden Gate Park. For whatever reason, and you know, I'm sure there are books written about it now, the city at the last minute said, nope, can't do it. Now, this is a big deal. You know, the Stones are coming to the Bay Area to do the free concert. Okay, so then they moved. They found another venue somewhat outside of town, another perfect venue. They started building the stage. Last minute, the owner said, nah, liability, too much, can't do it. So now they've got one day. Here they're coming, one day until their free concert. So this guy that owns this, ran this racetrack out in Altamont, said, okay, come on out here. And that free concert, which was done with so much really joy and everybody had so much hope for, turned into the disaster that was Altamont. And it wasn't, you can't blame it on the Stones, you can't blame it on the Hells Angels. It was one of those perfect storms where everything possible that could go wrong went wrong. And so then at the end, people said, well, that's it. The, you know, peace, love, and music generation is over. We had Woodstock as the beginning, and now Altamont, it's over. I subsequently photographed them again for one of Bill Graham's really great Day on the Green concerts and got some fabulous pictures. But it was, I always felt they got, you know, they got short shrift on that because it wasn't their fault, you know.
Did you feel like it was a bookend? You, as a matter of fact, a lot of your photographs from Woodstock are iconic. I mean, they're very well known. Did you feel like it was a bookend?
You know what? It was very hard to detach myself in those days to even tell you what I thought about anything.
Because lack of perspective.
Yeah, there was none. I mean, I knew that Woodstock was important because here was a disaster waiting to happen. You know, 300,000, 400,000 people there. Anything could have gone wrong, and pretty much nothing did, you know, other than small little things. So, I mean, that it deserves the mythology of the Woodstock mythology. It really does.
Mary and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'll tell you what, 60s was the best. It changed my life, baby boomer. But to be honest, I was 16 years old when Woodstock took place, and my mother said I couldn't go.
Right.
So there I was. But when that was over, there were. What's interesting is that in that time, as the comment was made, that these musicians were easily accessible to. And one of my favorites, being raised in the Toledo area, was Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, and went to a show there at North Baltimore Park, another small Woodstock made. And there were all these people that were there, and we got to meet them all. I walked around with Mitch Ryder before his show in North Baltimore Park in Ohio. But it changed everybody's lives, from Beatles on, but Janis and those people, I could relate to them. Love it still. Thank you so much. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Did you take photos of Mitch Ryder and those people that were not as well known but until later? But
well,
I was wondering if you took photos like that.
Yeah, I didn't. Unfortunately, I didn't get Mitch Ryder. You know, I wish I had actually gone to Detroit and spent a couple of, at least a month in Detroit with the Grandy Ballroom and all those places where the guys would go through all these great bands from Detroit. I mean, I did get Iggy Pop. There's a little place outside of Ann Arbor called Mount Clemens, and they had a teeny little, I think there were maybe 300 people there at that show, and it was Iggy and the Stooges. I mean, unknown, but very strange, you know.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Baron Wolman's going to speak tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center. You can learn more about that to go to WOSU.org/allsides. I hope we'll have a link there for you. Phil in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Barry, Phil Stichter calling.
Man, I remember you. This is like a blast from the past. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. I enjoy listening to you on the radio here.
Thank you.
Yes, and look forward to seeing you tonight at your speaking engagement.
We all look different, though, now, don't we?
Well, I'll wear a red carnation.
Okay, I'll be looking for it. Great, Phil. That's really good to hear from you, man.
Yeah, and I just wanted to know, what impact did the Hut have on you at Northwest?
Well, and the Hut is?
The Hut was a little, it's very funny, the Hut was is where anybody who thought they were creative hung out and drank coffee, you know. Unfortunately, I also worked at the Hut, too. And I was a terrible waiter. I remember going up to the people I would be serving food. Everything okay? Everything okay? Everything okay? And they said, would you leave us alone? Let us eat. Yeah. Those are good days.
Yep. Well, very good. And I look forward to seeing you tonight.
Good, Phil.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Phil.
Thank you.
If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. When you were actually technically an oldster.
Yeah, I was.
When you started working for Rolling Stone at the untrustworthy age of, I guess 30, weren't
right.
you?
Right. Nobody was supposed to trust us, were
so,
they?
Yeah. What was that like, or was there no difference? It was or a state of mind?
State of mind, total state of mind. I mean, everybody was so committed to the magazine and giving what each could contribute in his or her own way, you know. Jan was 21. I mean, stop and think. He hadn't even graduated. He was 21 years old when he came up with this idea, right?
And you were pretty impressed with him.
I was very impressed with him. I mean, how could you not be? He, first of all, he's very knowledgeable. And to this day, I think he's a great editor. And I'll tell you one funny story, though. He cares about words a lot. He still does. He did. But after we had published for 6 months or, I don't know, a year or something, there was a magazine called Communication Arts, which actually reviews various types of graphic arts magazines and ads and things like that. They gave us a raving review based not upon the words, right, but upon the pictures and the layout and the design and the art direction and all that stuff. And he was so upset because he didn't get the credit that he felt. But I mean, justifiably that he was due, you know, but I'll never forget that. Yeah, okay, pictures, pictures. To this day, he knows that pictures are important, but he doesn't care about them, interestingly enough.
Well, it is interesting because the use of pictures, I was going to ask you about how that evolved over those 3 years, because at first it was like strictly like a newspaper that wasn't that big, but it in 3 years it changed quite a bit, didn't it?
Well, I think
more prominence that, given to them, and
I think that the pictures pretty much were always important. Okay. I think they became some of them became larger, and then when we changed the format from newspaper to a quarterfold where it looked more like a magazine, of course we had individual photographs on the cover, and those were pretty powerful. But the art directors, they loved photos and they used them very well. I'll tell you one funny story I've got a million, but this is one that just occurs to me, speaking of the covers, is that Jan and I and my wife Juliana and his wife Janie were friends, socially friends, you know, in the early days. And I went out for issue number 11, I went out and I photographed B.B. King, great shot of B.B. King, another one of my absolute favorite shots of Johnny Cash for that issue, right? And I took him to the art director fully thinking that he was going to be on the cover. I also walked in, because I had taken some pictures of my then wife, who was a ballet dancer, a stack of pictures to give, that I gave to Jan. I said, take them home and show them to Janie, because I think these are pretty cool, and didn't think another thing of it. Well, I came back 2 days later after the issue had been published, and he had put that picture of my ex-wife on the cover of Rolling Stone. I was like, wait a minute. With no taglines, there was no reason. It's the only person that's ever been on the cover of Rolling Stone with no particular reason at all.
Wow.
Wow, yeah. On the cover of the Rolling Stone, right?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. We should talk about that song, too, in a little while. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Barry Wallman. He's the author of an upcoming book. It's about his work in 3 years with Rolling Stones, with the Rolling Stone magazine. It's called Every Picture Tells a Story, The Rolling Stone Years. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm WSU General Manager Tom Ryland saying thank you to everyone who gave during our fiscal year-end fundraiser. Your generous contributions helped us surpass our $500,000 goal. Thanks for your support of 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
Weekdays at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. The sixth season of Jazzoo kicks off Friday, July 8th with Red, White, and Blues featuring Kevin McGuire at the Columbus Zoo. Gates open at 6:30 with showtime at 8. Tickets and more details at jazzartsgroup.org.
The great apes seem to have rich emotional lives similar to our own. But just how smart are these animals? Wednesday night on WOSU-TV, a new generation of investigators is revealing the secret mental lives of great apes. Our evolutionary next of kin are turning out to be far smarter than most experts ever imagined. Scientists are at last zeroing in on what separates us from our closest living relatives. Watch Nova, Ape Genius, Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Barry Woolman is in the studio with me today. He was the first chief photographer for Rolling Stone magazine. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. That, of course, was the incomparable Jimi Hendrix singing Purple Haze in 1967. You've said that there's some musical artists that were impossible for you to take a bad picture of, and that one of these was Jimi Hendrix. And of course, you've already mentioned he will grace the cover of your new book.
Right. There was something about him, about how he carried himself, how he dressed, how he played, how he performed. There was every moment that I ever encountered him was unique, certainly unique photographically, because I photographed him several occasions, and I can't explain it. You know, there's just some people who the camera loves it, that person. And I happen to actually love it. That's another thing, apropos this whole shooting rock and roll for me, is that I love these guys. They were doing something. I can't play music, but they can. And music to me is so important in my life. Like, can you imagine life without music? No, impossible. So I had this affection for these people, and what I was trying to do with my photographs was reflect my affection, give them something back for what they had been giving me. You know, that was kind of an underlying emotional component to what I was doing. I didn't go in there and say, I love you. But you know what I mean?
Right.
I was just in such admiration of it. And so I thought that I had to do what I did as well as they do what they did. And I remember the first time I encountered Jimi Hendrix, it was in a motel room. And it was prior to his first appearance at the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco. And he was talking very quietly. You know, we were talking. He's like, oh, what'd you say, Jimmy? I can hardly hear you. You wouldn't think that Jimi Hendrix would be talking like this. And that evening, went to the concert. It was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He was just on fire. And, you know, and that was when I said, this guy is just unbelievable. And that's when I started taking all these great pictures of him, you know. Now, he was amazing. And ironically, think about it. The power of his music and his presence is as strong today as it was then, you know. And he died very young, well before his time. His version of the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Is there anything?
It feels like everyone's trying to copy it in some way ever since. What is maybe outrageous with it ever since, and nothing's ever come close.
No. I mean, it came from his heart. You knew it did. You knew there was a lot of emotion. There was a lot of experience in that moment for him that he was expressing. No, I was lucky. You know, I mean, I really was lucky to be there at the time.
Lisa in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have one question, odd one, I guess. Is there any performer that the photographer ever
Barry
felt
Woolman.
Really
yep.
daunted by?
Anyone
really
you were daunted by?
Daunted? Yeah. In what sense daunted?
Oh, I don't know, that they were too famous, or that maybe that their personality just wasn't. I know you mentioned that your photography was a way of your expressing your gratitude maybe to the performer, but I'm just thinking just as an observer, I don't know, maybe that's what I'm projecting onto it. Maybe, I guess just maybe any performer at all.
Well, no.
In any way daunted.
Yeah, in general, I respected him. They knew that I was there to do a job. I knew that. They knew, and so we got along pretty well. The only one that I had any trepidation by and about was George Harrison, the only Beatle I photographed, because No, and it wasn't. You wouldn't think that, but the circumstances were such that I didn't get a chance to really talk to him. We were sitting in the lobby of the AppleCorp building, and they had just taken over AppleCorp and were remodeling it, and it wasn't really done. And I was I'd taken my ex-wife to London with me. We're sitting there, and he comes in, and what do you say? Hey, George, how you doing? You know, that's not me.
I'd faint. Okay,
yeah,
go on.
Well, I didn't faint. I just said, okay, am I going to respect this guy? I mean, look, in retrospect, I wish I had talked to him a little bit more and said, you know, hey, look here, George, I get this shot. I mean, I got one fabulous shot. This is an iconic shot that I love. He's laying down on this couch reading Bob Dylan's Don't Look Back. And, you know, I had decided, okay, I'm just going to let him be. He knew I was there with the camera. It wasn't anything like that. But he didn't offer, and I didn't ask. And so I was like, oh, man. In retrospect, I keep thinking of the moments that I should have taken advantage of.
And he didn't object.
No, he didn't object at all.
He just kept reading.
He just kept reading, and as if I wasn't there. And I like that because I felt like I was a fly on the wall watching him be.
Thank you, Mr. Woman.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I guess when Lisa asked that question, I was thinking about maybe somebody who intimidated you. They were intimidated by it. You had said that you have a group of favorite pictures. Jimi Hendrix is obviously one of them. One of them also is Frank Zappa, a picture you took of him. And when you write about shooting that picture, you said you were nervous because he was so brilliant, and you felt like you didn't know enough about music to hold a conversation with him. And looking back, were most of your conversations with your subjects about music anyway?
No,
ultimately
they could not be because I was not schooled in music, you know. So I would always, what I would do is, as I told you, I'd find out a little bit about them. Oh, where are you from? What was it like growing up in East Lansing or somewhere like that, you know? And we'd start a conversation like that. But Zappa had also a reputation of being this eccentric human being, kind of a unpredictable eccentric. And that I knew. And it was really weird because I went in with a writer, and usually what happened, the writer would take the pic, would start doing the story, and then afterwards I'd kind of look and figure out what I wanted to do, take the pictures afterwards. It was much more comfortable for me that way. It seemed like for the also the subjects too. But I get there and I said, okay, Jerry, you're going to start talking. No, Baron, let's go out. We're going to go take some pictures right now. And I was like, uh-oh. this is
Frank
crunch
Zappa
time.
Talking.
Yeah,
okay.
Frank Zappa talking. And so what was interesting is he was living in the old Tom Mix house way at the top of Laurel Canyon Drive in L.A. And they were going to develop. At one time, they were going to develop this whole area. And somehow it went bad. And they left all this construction equipment, road construction equipment up there. And there was also a cave, and I don't know if it was a natural cave or an artificial cave. So the first thing he did, he goes into the cave, disappears, kind of sneaks out, sticks his head out. I'm taking a picture, of course. I mean, I'm not telling him to do anything. He's just on his own, being Frank Zappa, right?
Uh-huh.
Then we do that a little bit. Then he goes and crawls up on top of this bulldozer and acts. He's got this black jacket on, you know, big long black jacket. Acts like he's driving the bulldozer, and on it went. And I didn't have to say a thing to this guy. He was performing. I mean, it really was a performance for me, and I was so grateful afterwards. I didn't have to do anything, you know.
When you shot Tiny Tim in 1968, you were worried about his eccentricity and how to appeal to him. And you said that you had to do something to endear him to you, so you brought him a bouquet of daisies. And there's that shot of him. It's just an amazing shot. But I wondered, did you ever feel like you had to really manipulate people, like do something to make them like you so that...
No, the only story that I remember, and it was funny because I think the young man that's working here, you said his dad was an oral surgeon. And Janis Joplin, who I love to photograph, didn't always really like to be photographed, and she had a dark side and a light side, and she'd bring the dark side and sometimes to the photography session. I'd say, Janice, listen, it's not like going to the dentist here. This is just taking pictures. This is photography. And she'd break out into that wonderful little girl smile that she had. Well, one day I was photographing Big Brother and the Holding Company, and they show up, and she's got this look on her face like, oh, now what do I do? And she's got her hand on her cheek. I think something is weird. And anyhow, she had just been to the dentist, and her cheek was filled with Novocaine. She thought it looked like a balloon, but it didn't.
Right.
And I couldn't use the line on her that day, you know, because it really, she had been to the dentist, and photography was like going to the dentist.
And she'd really rather be. Owen from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, first-time caller, long-time listener. listener. I really appreciate you taking my call. I guess a comment and a question. I'm a baby boomer. I'm 60 years old. I grew up in the 60s and got to go to a lot of concerts up in Columbus and up in Detroit and stuff. And I saw Mitch Ryder in Detroit Wheels. I know what you're saying about Jimi Hendrix. He's a special person, very iconic. His music transcended and will transcend anything that's existing today. It'll outlive everybody. I went to a rock concert festival in 1971 in Griffin, Indiana. I remember it being called the Bow Island Soda Pop Festival. Does that sound familiar to you?
No, it does not. But I will tell you that in 1969, this other photographer, Jim Marshall, and I did a tour of festivals in the U.S. And to do a book. It was called a Festival, a Big Book of American Music Celebrations. And what we discovered is everywhere, just like the place you're talking about, there were festivals going on. There were rock festivals, bluegrass festivals, blues festivals. Something about music brought people together. And everybody was always happy at a festival, you know. So even though I hadn't heard of that one, I'm not surprised that, you know, they had one there.
Oh. It was quite large. They had well over 300,000 people there. So that was my Woodstock, because I didn't get to make it to Woodstock since I was in the Army and stationed over in Germany. But what you're saying about how music has changed from Woodstock to the concert with the Stones out in Oakland, I didn't get to make it to that one. I wish I had, but in some ways I'm glad I didn't, because the Hells Angels messed everything up.
What can I say? You're right. Everything you say. Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, Owen, for your call, and thanks for listening.
Thank you. Be cool and rock on.
Thanks, Owen. We have a few minutes left with Baron Wolman. He's a photojournalist and author of a new book. It's called Every Picture Tells a Story, The Rolling Stone Years. It's not out yet, but we have him now. So if you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Let's listen to some more music. We have Johnny Cash was one of the first artists that you photographed in 1968. Let's hear.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Now, that was, you shot him in 1968. I'm not sure if that rendition of the song was taken at that time, but you say that, you know, what he's singing about in that song was very evident on his face, and it was something that you could take a picture of.
Yeah, you know, anybody who's seen the movie about him understands that he struggled during his life in a variety of ways. And I was backstage at a little place called the Circle Star Theater in Northern California. Actually, it was 67, doesn't matter. But and it was backstage, and I took his picture, and the look on his face, I just didn't think he was going to be able to go out and perform. He just looked like the devil, or not the devil. It was just, there was something there that he was out in some other sad place, you know. Mm-hmm. But as it turned out, of course, he went out and he with his wife, and they did a great show. I remember that this particular venue had a rotating stage, so I'd be sitting there taking pictures of him, and then pretty soon he'd rotate away, and I only get the back of him, you know. But there was an interesting story about that particular photograph that you're talking about, where we were backstage. I took it in 67, and 40 years later or so, I had an exhibit, and somebody came up to me and said, "Oh, wow, I really like that picture of Johnny Cash and his wife June Carter Cash."
That's right.
And I said, "Well, what do you mean? This is Johnny Cash." And she said, "No, there's June Cash." I said, "You tell me where?" And she noticed that reflected in the mirror of the dressing room, out of focus, was June Carter Cash. And I had never, ever noticed it. Like, for 40 years, I'd never seen
it. That's amazing.
I was stunned, really. Yeah.
Do you ever just go back through your old pictures and look at them again and see what you can see?
Well, for this book in particular, you know, we had to go through a lot of pictures. And I found some stuff that I didn't even realize I had taken, pictures I had forgotten that I had taken, little gems that we found, you know, mm-hmm. new things that we put in the book.
That hadn't been published before?
Yeah, they had not been published, neither published nor seen, you know. It's like, oh, where'd that come from? You know,
that 40 years gives you that kind of perspective where you see more of the interest in it. And
Well, even though I mean, something different. It's funny, you go by them very quickly when you're choosing what you want to put in the magazine, you know, and the other ones that you push aside, you don't really examine closely.
You know, when we see the story of Rolling Stone writer Cameron Crowe depicted in that film Almost Famous, which was a lot of fun to watch and really interesting, are we seeing a facsimile of what you experienced during your days with Rolling Stone?
Yeah, pretty much. That's the way it was. I mean, you know, they exaggerate for effect and things like that, but it was action all the time. They still do. I mean, every 2 weeks we had to put out a new issue, and there was always something wild going on. And then Hunter Thompson, of course, showed up after I left and made the whole thing crazier than ever, you know. But that was a pretty accurate representation of how it was.
David and Bexley, welcome to the show. We just have about a minute, though.
I had a quick question.
Sure.
I'm interested in photography also. It's difficult, but I just wondered how you transformed yourself from a photographer artist to a photojournalist, or if there's, what's the process and how does it work?
Well, no, there was no process. I just have to tell you, I use photography to explore life. That's what I was doing. I was very curious about life from the very first time I picked up the first camera. And I just kept doing that. And a photojournalist essentially is looking around, looking to see what's going on. You can call yourself a photographer, you can call yourself whatever, but I happen to call myself a photojournalist because I was trying to reflect what was going on around me and share it with the people who got to see the pictures. As opposed to a studio photographer who creates pictures, I was trying to reflect reality as I saw it.
Thank you, David, for that call. Thank you, Barry Woolman.
Are we done already?
We're done. The hour's gone. It went by too fast. A photojournalist, author of other books, but a new one's coming out. Every picture tells a story. The Rolling Stone Years. Barry was the first chief photographer for the Rolling Stone magazine. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. It's really been fun.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.